Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Wesley Mission Victoria and broadcast through the Community Radio Network. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Hi, Rob Greaves here, and it's a pleasure bringing you part two of a three-part program on the life and times of 84-year-old John Larson. Born in Denmark, John followed the age-old profession of many Danes, going to sea. His sea adventures brought him to Australia, where he met his wife-to-be, Audrey Anne, who became Anne, the love of his life, and his wife. Making Australia his home, John tried his hand as a painter, but through the Danish consul, he finds himself back on ships. We share John's trips from Australia to Japan. Eventually, he became the manager of the first coal handling plant in Gladstone, Queensland. Yet, it's the story of how he eventually became involved in sailing to the Antarctic, which is the beginning of what is a most brilliant story, as John gives us his first-hand experiences and observations of this mighty white land. We pick up with John talking about his work as a supervisor, then as a sailor, on a cattle boat to Japan.
But then the idea was, of course, I was supposed to be in their office in Brisbane. So I just told them, I said, well, this is no good. So came back to the office and became the superintendent there. And then whenever we had ships, we loaded all the sheep out of Adelaide and Fremantle. So I went across and supervised that to a certain extent. And then we got an Australian manager, Graham Oliver, and he was a real cattleman, and he had connection with people up in Okinawa. So my little ship was sent up to Okinawa with a load of cattle here from Melbourne, and the skipper we had in those days, he only had a coastal ticket. So, of course, the old fella, he volunteered, and we had the trip up to Okinawa and came back again. Then there was another trip from Derby to Manila with a load of cattle on a big German ship. And then there was I can't remember the name of that one, there was another German ship where we loaded a hell of a lot of cattle up to Okinawa again. But instead of going the straight way from here up to out to sea and then up east of New Guinea, up to Japan, I suggested to the old man that he went up along the coast and through the Barrier Reef and up to Indonesia and that way, because the weather is much better and more suitable for the cattle. They're standing there and they're four legs.
Sure.
So I was a super up to TI and got off at TI and then drove back, and in the meantime, of course, my wife and the office had moved down to Sydney.
Oh.
So I drove down from Cairns. I stopped in Brisbane and got a job, so I didn't know what to do. I got back to Sydney and gone underneath the Story Bridge, the coat hanger, found a telephone box and rang the office up and said, well, where the hell is my wife? Where does she live and what? So she had the phone on and had found a little flat, and that took her a fortnight to find that. So I had to come in and tell her that we're going back up north. So we moved up to, I became the manager of the first coal loading plant in Gladstone, which was Barney Point. And then, unfortunately, the sandfly got the better of her, so we were only there for 14 months.
Right.
But that was the last.
That was the last.
The last of my sea experience there.
But now we can backtrack a bit, because you've also had what some of us would see as mighty adventures, because you've been to the Antarctic, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
How did that start?
Well, in the trade between Finland and UK, we only passed a little Denmark with 2 or 3 miles, you know. And the only thing that happened in those days, what you could call up on the telephone, but it was a little bit sickening, you know, that just a little bit of water between me and my young wife. Mm. I said, this is no good. We're going to find a ship that comes into Copenhagen once in a while. And in those days, we had the first ship in the company called the Keister Dan. So I just said to the super when I was home at one stage, so, well, what about a job on the Keister? Oh, he said, I didn't think you would be interested in that. I said, well, why not? So he got me on there, and that was how my seafaring in the ice all started.
So that ship went from Denmark down to the Antarctic, did it?
In the summertime, we serviced the trade up to Greenland, because in the old days, there was only one company that serviced Greenland, and that was a government instrumentality.
Right.
But since Greenland was developing a little bit too quickly, well, they had to charter ships. And on the east coast of Greenland, one had found zinc and lead, and the company got involved in that, and they found a little place up, we called it Mestersvig. And the keys that brought all the mining equipment up there and all this sort of thing. And that was how the trade really got involved. So we traded between Greenland and Copenhagen or Denmark in the summertime. And in the wintertime, there was a fellow out here in Australia called Phil Law, who has now passed away too. Phil was the Antarctic explorer out here, I suppose you could call him. He was a school teacher, and he started up, and nobody else wanted to have anything to do with the Antarctic Division. So Phil, he put his name down, and Phil was always a great admirer of Mawson.
Right.
Tried to be like Mawson, which didn't really work out. However, the ships he got hold of first, it was absolutely hopeless. There was a landing bar. How they could ever got that one to go down there got me tossed.
And so, then, sorry, for those of us who don't know about ships, what about it was inappropriate? I mean, it just wasn't made for the ice, or?
No, absolutely not. A landing bar, that was an LCT. That was an old leftover from the war years.
Right. You know?
Absolutely hopeless. From memory, I think it even broke down before it got out of port and then had to come back again.
Whoops.
Then they got hold of a Norwegian ship called the Totten, which was just as bad, according to Phil. And then Phil, he heard about the Keister Dan and how she was strengthened for sailing in the ice. So he got hold of the company and signed up a contract there. And that was really how it all started.
Now, having had so much experience in ships, you could probably be able to inform those of us who have got no experience, what sort of reinforcing has to be done for a ship to be able to be successful in the ice packs?
Well, how can I put it? On the Keister Dan, for instance, the side of the ship, which was all, in the old days, one only believed that only wooden ship could sail in the ice, which, of course, was completely stupid. But in a modern ship, the side of the ship, the steel plates there, are thicker than in a normal cargo ship. On top of that, we have got what we call ribs. They're the frameworks inside the ship that holds the side of the ship together. They are, on the Keister Dan, they were only 12 inches apart. So if you can imagine a rib case that goes down, so that gives you the strength there. And then the protection of the propeller is another thing that has to, the fins, the sort of forces the ice away from the propeller.
Right.
But the most important thing out of all that is really the knowledge of the ice. I mean, nowadays you've got people sailing down to the Arctic in just sailing boats. How that comes about, I got no idea. How they dare do it is beyond me, but never mind, they do that.
So can you recall your first voyage down there, what it was like?
Oh yeah, the first voyage, that That was quite simple. I mean, we all knew. The first thing you see is the iceberg. And the iceberg, compared to what we have up in the north, has got a completely flat top.
Oh, okay.
Right? And that could be 4 or 5 or 10 miles long. A great big floating things. Up north, it's like small mountains that float out. Mountains with a peak on it, you know. But down south, it's flat. Very, very spectacular. And as you get closer and closer to the ice shelf, well, you see the white stretch, like a, almost like you see a low cloud, like you see fog.
Right.
Right. Well, as you get closer and closer, the sky is still clear and all the rest of it. It's only the reflection from the ice up in the sky that give you the white. Okay. Sort of image of the whole thing, and that is the barrier of the ice.
Again, I wish I had been down there, but I haven't. But I would imagine that you can see a lot further there because the air must be so much cleaner.
Oh, yeah. You never get a cold in the Antarctic.
You never get a cold in the Antarctic?
No.
Why?
Because there's no germs in the air.
Okay, I'd never thought about that. No. It makes sense as soon as you say it, because you would assume going to a place that's so cold, you're going to catch a cold, but it's a virus, a cold,
yeah, but
isn't
see,
it? Yes.
People talking about being cold and miserable, it's all right, it's cold, but due to the fact that there's no humidity, you don't feel the cold as you feel like it is today, where it's only 5 degrees heat. It feels like in minus 30, but down there, you don't, well, obviously you're dressed to it, but you don't feel that unpleasantly of it. In a real summer down there, you can still take your shirt off and you can get a beautiful suntan.
Goodness me. Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Only for a couple of hours, of course. I wouldn't go out there in the middle of the night. But the sun is up a little bit longer, and, right. And when the sun is out, it's good.
Listen to older voices. Living history on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with John Larson. And John, who was a seaman, is recalling his experiences in regard to Antarctica.
What about the wildlife down there? Did you have much experience with that?
The first thing you see down there is, of course, what we call the pilots.
Pilots?
The pilots. And that the penguins, they're standing on the ice. And it's very interesting. It became most apparent on getting into Macquarie Island, where there's that many colonies. You can actually see them standing there, and you see the white chest. And as you cruise down along the coast, the white chest is still there because they're standing there looking at the bloody boat out. They can't understand what it's all about. And that's why
right.
We call them the pilot, you know.
Right. So they're very, are they inquisitive? You know, they're curious?
Yeah, they are. Well, you put the boat, the little motorboat in the water, you know, and you cruise around and for whatever reason, the next thing is that a couple of penguins that jump in the boat with you.
Really?
No trouble.
That really is an experience that few people will actually have the opportunity of participating in.
The funniest part is really when you get up in the ice and you get up and disturb them up in their colonies and you frighten them off a little bit and you see how they get back into the water and get away from you. Well, how they slide on the on their stomach, you know, it's like a toboggan. And how they jump out on the water, it's quite good, yeah.
Did you ever have the opportunity of seeing any of the king penguins?
Oh, yeah. We saw in Macquarie, well, could be many, many things, many different species, I suppose, but the one we really saw most of, that was what we call the rockhoppers.
Rockhoppers,
they are similar to what we got down at Phillip Island,
right.
Something like that. Well, then when you get down to the ice, well, then you've got the Adelie penguin and you've got the king penguins. And when you're real lucky, and this little story will tell you the story about the emperor penguin that comes out and visits you out in the ice.
You've mentioned the story. Can you tell us the story?
Well, in 1960, Fuchs, he decided to
Now, for people not who don't know Fuchs,
Sir Vivian Fuchs was the one that was in charge of the English society. It's called Falkland Island Dependency Services.
Right.
We just called them FITS.
Yep.
And he decided to take a trip down to the Antarctic again. He was the one there with Hillary, was trying to cross the Antarctic. Hillary came from the New Zealand side and Fuchs came from the Earth side. And unfortunately, Hillary, there was a bit of a problem there because Hillary got to the South Pole before Shackleton got there. So
that's another
story. But anyway, Fuchs, he decided to go down and have another look down there. And he got hold of two aeroplanes, which was going to help him down there with their surveys and this sort of thing. So we went to, after 2 months in dry dock, in the company's dry dock in Denmark, fitted out with new accommodation. We went to Southampton, down to the North Sea and down to Southampton, through the English Channel down to Southampton, where we loaded, and this is in the beginning of, I think it's the 9th of, let me see, yeah, the 9th of September, December, 1959. So we loaded all the stores and took the expedition members on board, and then we said goodbye to Southampton and went down to through the Biscayne Bay, and we spent the worst Christmas I have ever spent in my life. It took us 5 days to get across the Bay of Biscay. It was terrible weather, absolutely horrendous. So we never saw the Christmas tree or anything like that. And then to get the two aircraft on board, they were brought down to Montevideo from Canada. So we loaded them in Montevideo, had a little look at that little place. And the next thing, we went down to, that's right. Fuchs didn't come with us in Southampton. He flew down to Montevideo and joined us up down there.
Listen to older voices. Revisiting through recollections.
Then we cruised down to Falkland Island and stayed at Port Stanley, and we were there for some days, and then the trip started down to a little island north of, if you can imagine, the south tip of South America,
yeah.
Cape Horn. Well, if you go straight south, you come down to what we call Graham Land. On the west side of Graham Land is the Weddell Sea, and on the east side, that is the South Pacific. And we went down. On top of Graham Land is a few small islands, and one of the islands was called Deception Island, which was an old Norwegian whaling station which had been closed for many, many years. And we pulled in there. There was a little English base on the south side, and the Argentinian had a base on the north side of the island. And one of their hobbies between these two colonies was that every so often they went across and visited each other and burnt their huts down.
This anyway, is friendly?
So we spent some time there and built the two aircraft.
Right.
There was a pilot and a fitter. And the pilot was Pat. And I've got a little picture of here. Pat, he was an Irishman. He was the fitter, and absolutely charming gentleman. And he made drawings of the difficulties laid on when we got the airplane in the water and how difficult it was to bring them back on board the ship again. And here is a little sketch about one.
John's just passing me a notebook which has got all his notes and pictures and things in here, and I'm looking at a sketch of the Kister Dan with the seaplane in the ocean next to it. Okay, John, I've got to ask some questions because this is some interesting things here.
Well,
the boat, the Kister Dan and the plane are in the water, but it looks like there's a boat sinking next to it.
That's the motorboat, and the second mate, I was on board the plane.
Right.
We had been out on an expedition, and the second mate was supposed to get us up close to the ship so we could hoist it back on board. Well, apparently he was a lieutenant from the Royal Navy, and he wasn't too good in a damn motorboat. Anyway, that is just the difficulties. You see all the passengers up there watching the drama.
Because the wing's going through the side of the boat.
Well, that's just an imagination.
Oh, that's the imagination.
What could have happened?
Ah, okay, but the boat did sink, the motorboat.
No. But it nearly did.
It must have been entertaining for everybody.
It wasn't big. But needless to say, he wasn't put in the motorboat again.
Obviously, the planes did fly down there.
Oh, yeah. Well, after we built the two planes, we went out and we got into a little channel, and it's called the Bismarck Sea. And Bismarck Sea is the easiest way to get down to another base where we went into the Argentine base. And having relieved, we spent a few days there, having relieved the old base, or the old personnel from the base, and the new one went in there. And then we went out in the Bismarck Sea, and there's an island, big island, called Avalon Island on the starboard side. The South Pole is on the Ursa on the port side. And it's a shortcut down to the next base we had to go and visit, which is called Horseshoe Bay.
John will be back in part 3 with many more stories on Antarctica involving the thrills, adventures, humours and some disasters, all as seen and experienced by him and now shared with you. Next week, the conclusion of the Antarctic adventures of John Larson on Listen to Older Voices.